Hi, I'm Taylor Smurl, and I'm an experienced bartender.
And I'm Tommy Smurl. I'm an experienced drinker.
He's my dad, and together this is...
Neat! A weekly booze cast.
With history lessons, trivia, and a twist.
So pull up a stool to the bar and join us for the lowdown on your highball.
Alright, hello, welcome back. Hey Dad, how you doing?
Hey Tay, good, how are you doing?
Doing alright, just hanging out. Had a long day, did a lot of things today.
Yeah.
I've done all the things I can do, and there's still more things to do.
I know, my days have been that way a lot lately. It's just nonstop. We've been a little short-handed at work, so I've been having to be a jack of all trades and a master of none.
I feel like I keep thinking like I get some sort of reward for this, but the reward is just you did the things. That's it. That's the reward.
That's right. Virtue is its own reward.
It's like make my little list with all the boxes. I get to check the boxes at the end of the day.
Yeah.
But hey, that's you know, it's all right. It's all fun stuff.
It's all life. You gotta love it.
I thought so. We're kind of on a good trend here, where we did an episode, and within that episode, we found a topic for the next episode.
Yeah, it's something that I don't know about.
Well, we started with Cherry Hearing, and with Hearing, we talked about the Singapore Sling, so we got an episode out of that. And then when we were talking about the Singapore Sling, you were unfamiliar with Benedictine.
Yeah. Yeah, the only thing I knew about that was Benedictine monks, but I did think I'd heard of it, but when I saw the bottle, it was not what I had pictured, so I don't know if I just dreamed it or not. I don't know.
Well, we have briefly talked about Benedictine on the show way in the past. We did a Q&A episode for our patrons, and somebody asked a question about monks making booze. So if some of this sounds familiar to you long-term listeners, we have discussed it a little bit on the show before, but honestly, there's enough to Benedictine that it deserves the spotlight. So I thought we could just talk all about the unique history and some of the cool cocktail applications relating to Benedictine.
So basically what we're saying is this podcast is becoming another thing that Tommy doesn't know.
That's the subtitle for this.
Yeah.
Neat. We found something else that Dad doesn't know each week.
There's a lot of shit out there that I've never heard. I've led a sheltered life. I don't know.
I want to see how many episodes in a row we can get. I planned this one a little bit. Let's see if there's a thing in here that you're curious about that we can get next week out of. But that works, right? Because then you listeners at home, you know, maybe you have the same questions. You hear us talk about something and go like, oh, I don't know what that is. And then, oh, don't worry. Next week we'll tell you.
You know, Tommy doesn't know what it is. I spent my life just going in, beer. Beer, I want beer. Give me beer. So I don't know about any of these things. I spent my life drinking beer.
It is never too late to broaden your horizons.
That's right.
So that's what we're going to do. We're gonna introduce you to Benedictine, which is really delicious and cool. I think that there are some spirits that I learn like what it goes in, and I don't ever investigate it beyond that. So it's fun for me, too, to be like, oh, wait, this is cool for lots of reasons I didn't know. I maybe knew kind of what it is and how to use it, but you get a whole new perspective when you see what it is, where it came from.
Well, this sounds really good, and I've liked most of our endeavors into the liqueurs, like the limoncello and the drambuie and cream de mint and some of those. I love all those kind of things, so this really sounds like it's right up my alley as well. I can't wait to get a bottle of this.
I do think you're going to enjoy it, which, I mean, begs the question, what is it?
Yeah, what is it? Whatever it is, I'm going to like it.
I mean, honestly, who knows is the answer to that. In as much as Benedictine is made with a top secret, heavily guarded recipe, it's one of those, you know?
If they told you, they'd have to kill you.
Yeah, like a few people are allowed to know a portion of it, but no one's allowed to know the whole thing. One of those things. But we do know some things about it. It is made with 27 unique herbs, spices, flowers, roots, all sorts of stuff go into it. And they are infused into a grain-neutral spirit. So the way they do this is they actually group these ingredients into four specific bundles, and they distill those four separate, they call them esprits, that's just French for spirit, in copper pot stills, which tends to be a more concentrated flavor. And then these four separate esprits or spirits are aged separately for 8 months. Then they're mixed together with honey, that's for the sweetness and flavor, and then saffron for the color. They're heated to combine, and then they're aged again for four additional months in oak barrels, and then filtered and finally bottled. So you kind of have these four, like, variables that are made separately, and then they're combined together, and then go forward to produce Benedictine.
You know, somebody did a lot of lab work to come up with that. So there's 27 different ingredients, and they separate them in some manner. This many in this one, this many in this one. And then they age them all separately with the base spirit and don't put them together till the very last minute before they put it in the bottle, basically.
And possibly, you know, it might be a set recipe where X amount of this goes in. Or it could be something where, like with a lot of blended scotches, where you kind of blend differently based mm-hmm. on how different years come out. So it could be something where they like the control of having those four separate batches so they can... Oh, well, this yield is more flavorful in this area. The herbs are brighter, or the citrus is more dominant, or whatever. So we're going to balance it out with something else. You know, it could be that they use these as almost like perfume blending, which makes sense. It's French. It makes sense.
Well, of all the things we've talked about, this sounds to me like the most complicated, complex type blending and you know, aging that we've covered.
It's quite a process. And now they admit to honey, obviously, angelica and saffron. But pro tasters have sussed out more flavors that they feel are definitely in it. Lemon balm, juniper, aloe, cinnamon. There are a lot that you can kind of pick up on when you taste it, but none of those are confirmed. As far as what it tastes like, well, it's got a earthy honey flavor. It definitely has that, I don't know how else to describe it other than it kind of tastes like Christmas potpourri. It has that very distinct profile.
Well, it said fir cone is in there too.
Possibly.
Yeah. F-I-R, not F-U-R. Fir right. cone, yeah. Like the tree, the fir.
The tree, yeah.
Yeah. But, I mean, they got pine cones in there. What do you know about that?
Yeah. Well, I mean, it does, this is... We'll eventually have to do an episode on this. Is one of my favorite spirits, like Bekarovka. It has that same flavor profile as Bekarovka, and that it's like this warm. It's like a candle you'd get at Bath and Body Works. It's cinnamon. It's a little bit of that Christmas tree fir, mm-hmm. a little bit of nutmeg, anise. Like there's something there that just tastes like ginger. I don't know. I mean, I don't think, there's not ginger in this, but it's that flavor profile that you're familiar with. And it is, it's really delicious. Like when I just tried it earlier and I was like, I just want this in coffee, like on Christmas morning.
Well, at one point they did make a version of it with this and a coffee liqueur, but apparently it wasn't very popular because I think that was like 1977 and then they quit making it a while later. So
I'm bummed by that. That sounds like something that should work.
Yeah. Yeah. I was excited when I read that. Then it said they don't make it anymore. I went, oh, damn it.
You just put it in coffee. There you go.
Yeah.
You've made the Benedictine coffee liqueur.
Yeah.
Now, it is, obviously, I think, if you haven't tasted it, a good way of always thinking about a spirit is what it compares to or what it can be subbed for. But like a lot of these, sort of the name is well known just as its own entity. It is not easily replaceable because it does have some similarities with something like Drambuie. We've talked about Drambuie in the past. It is a honey flavor, but Drambuie is heavy with the honey and scotch. It's a little bit more like just aggressive. It's not a one-to-one stand-in. You also sometimes get comparisons with yellow chartreuse to Benedictine. And as far as the sort of herbal flavor, I can kind of see that, but it is much more earthy, spicy, and mellow than yellow chartreuse. It's not as bright. It's not as bitter. So it really does just sort of stand alone. I mean, to me, the only thing that I could really think was comparable was a less sweet or a more sweet Bekarovka. But that assumes you got a Bekarovka on your back bar, which is way less likely.
I've never heard of Bekarovka either. That's a new one to me.
It's also good in your coffee. Mm. So, you know, point being, it's hard to replace. And I think a good thing to consider is a lot of these common replacements, Drambuie or Chartreuse, they're just as expensive, if not more so, as Benedictine. So you might as well just get the Benedictine.
Well, I liked also that one of the things that they said for a replacement is B&B, which is made by them. It's got that in it. It's Benedictine and brandy mixed together.
Yeah, I don't know if that's really, I mean, yes, but also no. Like, it is a replacement in that Benedictine is in B&B. But
yeah.
I also, and I don't know, it depends liquor store to liquor store. So B&B is another product that Benedictine makes that is a blend of brandy and Benedictine, his dad said. But you're more likely, if a store has Benedictine, if it's going to have one, it's just going to have regular Benedictine.
Mm-hmm.
It's probably not going to have both.
Yeah. So. Yeah. And they said the main difference with that is it's drier.
Yeah.
As opposed to the sweetness in the Benedictine.
That's more or less what it is. It's honey, it's herbal, it's spiced, it's pretty soft, it's really delicious. But where does it come from? Next question. It's currently made in France, but its origin story, I want to kind of go all the way back to the beginning for this. And it starts more or less in Italy. That's sort of where the story begins. But I do want to emphasize the story element of this, in that there is a story that the company that is Benedictine has devised behind it that is really cool and alluring. There's not a lot of hard evidence about its truth, but
it's a marketing ploy.
Probably that. But I think it's maybe an exaggeration, not a total fabrication.
Yeah.
Which we'll get into as we get into it. But I don't think it's totally false. But just as I tell you this, it's not fact. It is the story that the label tells, that the website tells. You don't have a lot of hard evidence backing it, but it's still a cool story, so it's fine.
Well, you couldn't have a product named Benedictine without tying it to the Benedictine monks, whether it really is or not.
I think it still might. I feel like you could make the argument that it still is tied to the Benedictine monks, but maybe not quite aggressively as the story goes. So
yeah.
So we start, of course, with the namesake. The Benedictine, as the name of the product, comes from the Benedictine monks who supposedly invented it, and they took their name from Saint Benedict of Nursia, where our story starts. So Saint Benedictine of Nursia was an Italian monk born in 480 and lived until 547. Just a very quick bio. He was born to a well-off family. He was sent to Rome to study. He was sort of put off by the decadence of Rome, decided to go hermit himself into a cave for a couple years and work on his faith. And along the way, he devised a new set of rules for monastic life. He's the patron saint of, like, a ton of things, but one of which is, like, spelunking and caves. And you get why, because
they spelunked in the 400s?
Well, I mean, maybe that was like a later application of like his patronhood, but he just kind of would come, like, people were always like, no, come live at our monastery, come live at our church, like, we want you to be here, and he'd be like, no, I think I might go back to the cave though. I like the cave. I might go back to the cave. So there's a lot of back and forth between. He like wrote this. His biggest contribution was this Rule of Saint Benedict, which was a prevalent structure in the religious practices of monks throughout Europe. It was eventually adopted, and you know, it had a very specific, like, a focus on moderation. It kind of accepted failure. It focused as much on, like, rest and education as it did prayer. So this kind of, you know, he was like a work-life balance guy back in the, like, Renaissance times or before that.
The cave part makes me think he was descended from Fred Flintstone or something.
Well, I don't know. I think, you know, he's just he found his inspiration in caves. Or he just liked to be alone. Who knows?
Benedictines, patron saint of spelunkers everywhere.
I think there are definitely days that I've had out in the city where if there was the option of going to retire in a cave, like a nice familiar cave. Like, yeah, it's cave time for me. Taylor needs some cave time. But anyways, so Benedict writes the rules of Saint Benedict. All these monasteries follow it. Fast forward to 1510, when a Benedictine monk living at the Abbey des Camps in Normandy decided to use his study time to get into all sorts of fun things: alchemy, botany, and the healing arts. So this monk, named Dom Bernardo Vincelli, took detailed records of his experiments, and he experimented with different medicinals, herbs, roots, flowers. He was attempting to make a formula to revive his brethren when they were tired or sick. And there was one particular recipe that really was the favorite of the house, which would eventually become Benedictine. According to legend, the liqueur gained a reputation outside of the abbey when Francis I, during a visit, sampled it, and he exclaimed, "On my honor, I have never tasted anything better." So the monks started producing it, you know, just to distribute to the surrounding areas and offer their Benedictine locally until the French Revolution in 1789. Put a damper on the whole religious booze-making industry.
Yep, they burned everything to the ground.
Well, not everything. The monks all ran away. The
monks flew east, the monks flew west, the monks flew up.
They left. Ain't it there. Vincelli's grimoire or manuscripts, they survived. They were sort of like just commandeered in the takeover of the abbey. They kind of got passed down, traded around. They were eventually procured by Prosper Elie Couillard, whose grandson, Alexandre de Le Grand, who's already a successful wine and spirits merchant, would eventually stumble across them in his family's collection. And he would find this favored recipe and use it to base his own unique spirit that he would produce in 1863. Now, this is where I say the story. This is the story that Le Grand told about how he came across the recipe for Benedictine. So anything that I said prior is questionable. Can't be disproved, but can't be proved. But this is where the definite, like, recorded stuff starts, in that Le Grand definitely created Benedictine in 1863.
I think that it's interesting. There were two things that he felt he wanted to do to make his bottle stand out and to associate it with this story. And the one is the shape of the bottle. That wasn't an accident. He wanted a bottle of a distinct shape. And then the other is the placement of the big letters D-O-M on the front. And, of course, that D-O-M meant Deo Optimo Maximo, which is to God most good, most great. So he was tying it to the monks, is what he wanted to do there, because that was a saying that's used at the beginning of the documents by the Benedictine order to dedicate their work.
Well, and it's also a subtle nod to the possible creator of the recipe, in that Dom was used as like a sort of master. So it was a Latin word, dominus, which was given to Benedictine abbots. So this monk that supposedly created it, Dom Bernardo Vincelli, his first name wasn't Dom. He was dominus.
But I really believe, though, that this guy was a slick marketer, this Alexandre Le Grand, and that he kind of built that story to back up the drink and legitimize it. And I found it funny because a couple of articles said, this is questionable whether this is completely true, but it makes a good story. Whereas one of the other ones I read, it quoted it as gospel. This is what happened. So yeah. I wondered, did they know this, or are they part of the plot?
I mean, this is, we come across this in a lot of liquor history, where if you tell a story good enough, it becomes fact. Just to a lot of people. This is definitely a case of that. It's a good story. It doesn't seem to specifically be harmful in any way that I can envision. It definitely was a good, and that's one thing I think you can say about Le Grand, is he was a good salesman with the bottle design, the story, and it didn't stop there. He wrote to the Benedictine monks you know, using this sort of story to get use or get like legal use of their coat of arms, their name. So he had their full endorsement of this spirit. He also, along with being a successful like wine and liquor merchant, he also had ties to the art world. He had a long successful career as an art trader. So he recruited the likes of a ton of like well-known artists at the time, like Alphonse Mucha, like Luis Abema, these people that made these gorgeous posters and like little advertisements to use all around France and internationally. One of the paintings even ended up in like the World's Fair in the 1900s. So when we have such, whenever I see those beautiful, like Art Nouveau posters of like a lady drinking like an aperitif or a spirit, you know, so many brands embrace that kind of advertising, art advertising. He was one of the first to really do that. He was doing that long before it really was popular, kind of just get that association with high art, with his product.
Yeah, this guy was really ahead of his time, it seems like, in how he was promoting it, made it that big, you know, to where it was. And it wasn't even that popular. I mean, like 15% of the production was sold in France where he was at. 45% of it went to the United States.
Yeah. Well, so it was an international success.
Yeah, yeah. Very big.
Well, and he wasn't just, he was a good businessman. Within like a decade after the launch, it was selling 150,000 bottles a year, and he continued to grow into the new century. He had a sort of a vision of like making this beautiful distillery / palace, which he did. It still is there. It's the Palace Benedictine, and it's like you can go and see the production, how it's made. He also wanted to be able to like have all of his art and manuscripts, his whole collection. He was very much like an eclectic collector. Eclector?
Eclectic collector.
He collected a lot of cool shit, and he had it on display. So he created this beautiful palace where you could come see it. But on the factory side of things, he was very much guided by his faith, and he really wanted to take care of the people that made his product. So, like, he set up pension funds for his workers. He set up workers' comp. So if you were injured on the job, like, you were covered, you were taken care of. He opened an orphanage under the Benedictine company. He opened, like, a company orchestra to enrich his workers and his visitors. So, you know, he had some grand ideas of what to do with his success, which I think are pretty cool.
Well, Europe has been known for things like that. You know, you had what Guinness did for their people. You had, Lever Brothers over there? That was another one. And then Cadbury was another one that built homes for people to improve their lives and provided free health services and stuff like that.
Which is such a stark contrast to also the horror stories that are the sort of industrialized, it's like you get the same other side of it. He took care of his people for the most part, and I mean it, all of this worked together to make it an internationally successful brand. It got a little boost, specifically like in the UK post World War I, because the soldiers were returning from France. They brought back with them a taste for it. So it's sort of a regional thing, not really like a outside of UK way of drinking Benedictine, but Beninot, which is just Benedictine in hot water, which you'll find in the UK is like a colloquial reference to that. So.
Well, I thought that was weird when I read it until you were describing it to me and saying it tastes like Christmas.
Yep.
Well, that would be like a hot toddy kind
absolutely,
of like,
yeah.
You know, just add hot water and you got it. You don't have to add anything else.
No, absolutely.
So that'd be real good. Yeah, so that's what they call it in East Lancashire. And they said that that in that same area is the Burnley Miners Club, and it's reputedly the largest single customer of Benedictine.
That's where you go to drink Benedictine.
Yeah, the Burnley Miners Club.
Oh, I'm going to go there and drink Benedictine.
I like, too, that they got back to the old story of this is medicine when it first came out. It has medicinal value. The last two we've had, they've said, nah, it's strictly for entertainment purposes. Yeah. You're just drinking this for the taste or the effect. But this one, they said, oh, no, this is medicinal, at least when it started out.
A monk made this. It's medicinal.
Yeah, all the monks had to say that.
That's why they got to make it.
Hey, I'm not monkeying around here.
I'm trying to do God's work and heal my brethren with alcohol. Me too, man. Me too. But nowadays, I mean, it currently exists in over 200 international markets. I thought this was interesting. As you mentioned, it sells more so outside of France than in. Mm-hmm. The biggest markets, U.S., still a massive part of the market share, but also Malaysia and Singapore. Big fans of...
Well, they make a lot of slings over there in Singapore, right?
Yes.
They got to have it on hand for that. That's the national drink. They all got to drink that.
A lot of Benedictine just for that reason.
Breakfast, lunch, and dinner.
Well, a lot of the... We'll talk in a minute about some of the cocktails it goes in, but a lot of them are very small pours of Benedictine. You know, you're not using 2 ounces of Benedictine. You're using... half an ounce, maybe 3/4 ounces, but not a lot. So to be one of the biggest order, you're blowing through a lot of drinks because it's mainly used for cocktailing.
I read one that said to get used to using that in your drink, you might start with the bar spoonful of it and work your way from there.
Yeah, and you'll see that like some recipes will kind of go back and forth like half an ounce or bar spoon, and it really just depends on your palate. Although, I don't know, I get that with some more aggressive spirits, it's really not. I don't know, like it's really delightful.
Yeah, I think it's the sweetness is what they're talking about more than anything.
I could believe that. But it was acquired by Martini and Rossi in 86, and then Bacardi in 92, who still owns it, who just owns the brand. But it's still made in its old distilleries, not far from where that original monastery was possibly in France. Still being made by the same recipe in the same way, you know.
But by vampires now?
Well, not by the same people.
Well, Bacardi's, isn't that the vampires on the label?
Oh, it's a bat.
Aren't they vampire bats?
Oh no, I don't think so. I don't think that the Bacardi, like the owners of Bacardi, are like making it also. They're just the distributors. When we talk, like, with these big names, like, you know, it was like Suntory or Budweiser or Bacardi, there's these big conglomerates that just buy all these little brands, and they just distribute it. It just puts them in their portfolio.
Well, that's because they're vampires. They've been around so long, they can amass all the liquor.
Well, that's the goal. That's how vampires take over the world. They get all their liquor.
They own all the liquor.
I don't think that's not a hard sell at all. Like, okay, so wait. I get to be a vampire, and I get access to an excellent spirits catalog. Okay, yeah. You had me a vampire, but sure, I'll take the booze, too.
Yeah, two vampires. Two vampires conspiring, they said, how do we take over the world? And the one says, well, candy's dandy, but liquor's quicker. can't argue with that logic, can you?
That went down. Vampire logic. Can't argue with it. So outside of regular Benedictine, as Dad mentioned earlier, they offer B&B, so that Benedictine cut with brandy. It became a popular way of drinking it in the 30s specifically, like drinking, you know, we were drinking a lot of drier cocktails at the time. Manhattan, mm-hmm. old fashions were very popular. So a lot of people would order their Benedictine with brandy. The company saw this and just decided to bottle their own. Like, oh, you don't need to order it as a cocktail. You can just get it as is. So that's where that originated. And then
we will mix your drink for you.
Yeah. Kind of the same way that, you know, and I don't know, I think we've talked about this before, but like Fernet and Fernet Branca, like Branca Menta, why it exists is because a lot of people were mixing Fernet with mint and sugar. And so Fernet just went, oh, well, what if we just gave you one that was minty and sweeter and make a second labeling out of?
Will you buy more?
Exactly. Like, you don't need to buy those other ingredients. Just buy our stuff and pour more in a glass. It's a good strategy. It seems to work out for a lot of brands.
Sell people what they want. It's a great marketing strategy.
Right? If it's already all there in the bottle, they don't need to buy anything else for it. It's a consistent...
Just pour the bottle and drink.
Now we're getting almost too much in that direction with all the bottled cocktails. I don't know. I see so much discourse going on in like bartender Twitter about, is this good? Do we like this? I don't know. I like it when I want to go drink in the park, but I hate it in that it's maybe killing the art form of cocktails. Who knows?
It won't replace a well-made cocktail.
Hopefully not.
It's like you say, it's for when you're on the go, you accept that as part of it, yeah. But not when you really want to sit down and enjoy a drink. There is a vast difference. You have taught me that.
Well, and speaking of like unique experiences, there is a single cask Benedictine that you can get. I think it's only available at the Palace in Normandy.
Mm-hmm.
And it's once again a blend of Benedictine and brandy, but it's aged in limousine oak. It's a very specific blend. It's a very specific aging. It's also a little higher proof. It's 43%, whereas the regular labels are 40%, so just standard proof. If you visit the Benedictine Palace, you can try the special Benedictine
single cask.
But, all right, so that's what it is. That's its history. Most important question, how do you drink it?
Well, you can drink it straight over a big ice cube.
Yeah. Yeah, it's you know, once again, it's like not some liqueurs are like lower proof. You know, they're 13, 20%. They're a little on the sweet side. This is sweet, but it is also like full proof. It is 40%. So it's not any different than sipping on a regular spirit. And it opens up lovely with a little bit of water or... Yeah, a big cube. Cutting it is also a simple way to drink it, just with a little, obviously a little brandy, a little scotch. A lot of the cocktails that you drink with it are little, just sort of spin-offs of that. And there are quite a few well-known cocktails. It's because of its popularity, like specifically in like the 30s, it found its way into a lot of cocktails that now they might not be that first or even that second tier of like well-known drinks, but they are. Call drinks if you're at a well-educated bar.
Yeah, I saw a few of them. Some of them are just like putting some of that in some champagne.
Yeah.
And so they're real simple, several of them. They're not, you know, multiple ingredients. So.
Well, we talked about the Singapore Sling, which you covered last week. There's the Honeymoon Cocktail, which is a classic from the 30s. That's Benedictine, apple brandy, curacao, and lemon. So that's, you know, sort of other flavors that we've talked about at this point. The brandy, you know, it's a little bit like sort of like a sour build there, but everything there makes sense. Some people just cut it with milk and they call it a milk and honey. It's a little bit of a low ABV cocktail. You could probably
fill
that up with something.
We've come up several times with milk being involved in making cocktails with some of these different things. And I don't see milk as mixing with, you know, a liqueur or something like that. That kind of turns my stomach to think about it.
What about a white Russian?
What, does that have milk in it?
Well, it has cream.
Oh, well, that's true. Yeah, used heavy cream in those, yeah.
I feel like, I mean, the idea of just Benedictine and milk, I do think that that's a little, that sounds fine. I bet it tastes nice. I bet it tastes like a sweet, spiced milk. But I think you could build off of that and add like a base spirit and use cream instead of milk to kind of cut down on the volume and make something really nice. So I'm sure that's definitely done. I see coffee and milk Benedictine cocktails on a lot of menus.
Now, there was one that I saw, there was a recipe for this, and I thought, now this would be Taylor's drink, knowing your love of Japanese culture. The Toji Moon.
I haven't heard of that.
If I'm pronouncing it right, T-O-J-I.
Yeah,
Moon. Toji Moon. It's got Nigori Sake and Yuzu Marmalade and red bean juice.
And Benedictine?
And Benedictine, yeah.
Yeah, interesting. That's not it. Where is that from?
In Japan, the winter solstice is known as Toji and is observed by sitting in Yozi-infused baths and eating auspicious food such as red beans and lotus root. So this drink was kind of concocted based on that.
Oh, interesting. Well, there were a couple more. We were talking about this earlier. You said the chrysanthemum, the... oh god, the I always want to, the Bobby Burns. I always say Rob Roy. Yeah. Two different drinks. Yeah.
Bobby Burns, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I was wondering if you'd ever heard of those, because I thought, what in the world? Are those real drinks?
Yeah, they are. I mean, they're, you know, kind of in that category of like, I can't say anyone has ever ordered either of those from me ever, or I've ever seen one ordered. There are those drinks that I think, you know, if you work at like a very renowned cocktail bar, you probably have on the back of your brain to like, just in case you want to know how to make them. And they're all simple drinks. I mean, those are what, like one of them,
right?
A Scotch Benedictine situation, and other ones like a vermouth and Benedictine, like bitters situation. Like, so they're not too complicated.
It's a vermouth forward drink, and you don't have very many vermouth forward drinks. Yeah.
Yeah.
So that's kind of unusual. I'm not a fan of vermouth, really, so I don't think that one would appeal to me.
I like a low ABV cocktail. I like a vermouth cocktail. But I think that as far as, like, in all these drinks, outside of the Singapore Sling that use Benedictine, probably the one that has the most history to it is the most popular, the most storied cocktail is the Vucare.
I'm glad that you pronounced that for me, because when I was reading it, I'm thinking, I wonder how you say that, Vocari.
Yes. Well, good try.
Drew Carey's brother, Vo.
Yes, absolutely. That is not who the cocktail's named for. The Vucare is a classic New Orleans cocktail. And it combines rye, brandy, Benedictine, sweet vermouth, and bitters. Really a staple of the city, one of those drinks that you should seek out. You should seek out at a well-stocked cocktail bar. It's delicious, but especially if you're in New Orleans, one of those drinks that you want to try. I love that New Orleans has so many cocktails that, like, it claims, because they definitely were made mm-hmm. there. Like, I don't know of a different – I don't think there's another city in America. There are a lot of cocktails that New York kind of claims, but, like, there's that fun mix of history of, like, who knows? New Orleans has the background to be like, no, we made all of these drinks first. This was us.
Yeah. Well, once you told me it was a New Orleans drink, then I thought, well, no wonder it's pronounced that way.
Yeah.
And then I also thought, well, if I'd have known that, you look at that name, that looks like a New Orleans name. Mm-hmm.
Well, I thought instead of going into the history of the Vucare, because we're about at time for this episode, we should just keep going with what we're doing, since you don't know what a Vucare is.
No, I didn't even know how to pronounce it.
Well, I think that we should just come back next week and tell you all about the Vucare, because it's got a ton of cool history there. And I also just always love talking about drinking in New Orleans.
So here's another edition of Something Else Tommy Doesn't Know.
We found something.
You don't have to look too hard. I found that as I get older, I know less. I don't know.
You all take bets. How many episodes do you think we can get in a row? Connecting, it's like 6 degrees of Kevin Bacon, but it's just like, how many episodes can something in the episode Dad be so unfamiliar with that it spawns an entirely new episode?
Because he doesn't know about anything.
Of a very specific area of interest. No one knows about this stuff outside of people that are nerds about it. I don't want you to feel bad about that.
Yeah, and I have, like, relatives that are from New Orleans, and I didn't even know about this.
Well, yeah, you get to learn. We're going to learn together.
Yeah, learn about Vucare.
There you go.
So. Sounds like it might have something to do with voodoo. I don't know.
No, but, well, I mean, well, we'll get into it.
It should have Peychaud bitters, because I need something else to do with those.
Hey, but see, you know that. You know Peychaud's in New Orleans.
Yeah, that's what I mean. I learned that. I'm learning this stuff as we go. I just don't know it ahead of time.
That's all that matters. You're collecting knowledge. You're becoming more powerful with each episode.
Someday this will be a record of where you took somebody that was completely ignorant of everything to do with drinking culture and educated them over this publicly done several year period.
Hey, you teach me things too.
I teach you what not to do.
But I'm psyched though. We're gonna take a trip next week to New Orleans, talk all about the Vucare.
All right.
And hopefully we're batching our videos as Dad can get his hands on some of these more eclectic cocktail ingredients. But I definitely want to mix up some drinks with Benedictine, and we should go back to the cherry hearing too, because there were a lot of good drinks you missed out on there.
Yeah.
So we'll got to
do
with
a
those.
Singapore sling and some of these others. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I feel like I feel very, very extra this past week. Cause now that I had everything to make a Singapore sling. So I really just wanted to like try it. It's been a while. I don't think I've ever made one of them. I've ordered them at bars before. I've had them at tiki nights. I've never just made one on my own. I'm like, it's not that complicated. But now I just like, there's a difference between making like a little easy sour at your house and making like a 6-ingredient pickup at your house just on a Tuesday night. Like, oh, you know, just going to have a little Singapore sling.
Well, I'd need my list there. Now, I've got committed to memory a whiskey sour. I could make that, but
we'll get there.
But
we'll
for
get
a there. Singapore sling, I need the list in front of me.
if anybody is curious where the videos are, they are, Patreon exclusives now. For just $1 a month, you can have access not only to our new videos, but all of our old videos. But you can check us out there. There are still new things going up on the regular Neat YouTube. We've got some things coming out all month long and some new video series. Those are free. There's no subscription needed or anything. If you want to support us, we would love that. Check out our Patreon for other rewards, not just videos, stickers, coasters, all sorts of stuff.
Yeah, and more of us.
More of us. And bespoke cocktails. Mm-hmm. I'm curious what that means. I guess you should pay a dollar.
Yeah, I've gone from making edible ones to actually making drinkable ones.
Hey, your last one was, you got rave reviews.
I know. I know. I'm impressed. I've got to put mom to work more often to help me out there.
So mom got rave reviews on the last one.
Hey, I helped. I helped steer it. She just put the finishing touches on it. She has time to sit at home and taste test it. I got to get home from work and get that to work mixing.
Okay, so mom's your bar manager. You're like your bartender.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
If you want to find us elsewhere, you can find us on Instagram and Twitter at NeatBoozeCast. You can email us at NeatTheBoozeCast@gmail.com. And now that we're working a week ahead of time, if you have any thoughts, if you have any experiences in New Orleans or with WooCraze, you can talk about that over on
Facebook.
There you go.
Facebook, Neat the Boozecast group.
Yeah.
Or if you're all right there. Yeah, there was a lot of remarks about Cherry Hearing. That one made the rounds there. Nice. Yeah, people were singing its praises and gave me some other recipes for some other drinks I want to try.
You know, it makes sense now, like, and we'll get into this in the videos when we actually just try the stuff, but like Cherry Hearing and Benedictine seem like things that would taste delicious together, because you've got like fruity, rich cherry and then like spice and honey, like, you know, you learn the DNA. Yeah. It's like, oh, of course that makes sense. Of course that's delicious. Well, thank you all for discussing things over there in the Facebook. Thank you, Dad, of course, for being here.
Well, thank you, Taylor, for having me. I always learn something. But, you know, when you're working from the bottom, then everything's new.
No, but I mean, we're coming from different angles. But a lot of this, too, is like, I just learned how to work with a spirit. I never really got to slow down and, like, learn why to appreciate it or where it came from. So even if I can tell you kind of what it tastes like and kind of what it goes in, I don't. A lot of this too is, you know, fun for me.
Well, good. I'm glad my ignorance made fun for you.
That is not what I said at all. I'm not gonna fight you. Hey, I've been Taylor Smurl.
I've been Tommy Smurl.
And this has been
me. WooCraze kind of sounds like Baccarat. We drink WooCraze and play Baccarat. You know what that is, right?
See, I just got something I don't know. What the hell is Baccarat?
Have you ever seen like a James Bond, that card game where they deal out of that box and slide the cards out? They call it a shoe or something like that, or a boot or something, and they deal the cards out of that? That's called Baccarat? Yeah, it's called Baccarat. It's some fancy game they play on James Bond movies. I don't know.
You do your research on Baccarat. Tell me more about that.